Chapter 40, Picking Up the Threads. The last time we had crossed the Alps, there had been snow on each side of the road through the St. Gotthard Pass. That snow had now melted, exposing the rock beneath, though the surrounding peaks glittered white and immaculate in the morning sunshine. As before, I experienced a slight nausea and was glad when we began making the descent to Aldermatt. From Aldermatt, after a further descent, we drove on almost as far as Altdorf, pulling up for the night on a small side road when we were a few miles short of the town. The following day found us in Lucerne. On the way we had a fine view of the lake, which was misty, with rainbows overarching the grey waters. In Lucerne we walked around for a while, had a coffee and did a little shopping, then drove on to Basel via Olten. By this time it was raining heavily, and shortly after 3 o'clock, having crossed the Franco-Swiss border, we pulled up at the side of the road beneath the sheltering eaves of a stretch of forest. Here we ate, and here, the weather continuing very dull and dismal, to quote my diary, we spent the evening absorbed in our books. For the last few days I had been reading two books. One was Ronald Siegel's The Crisis of India, the other Elmer O'Brien's The Essential Plotinus, a new translation of selected treatises from the Aeneids. What India's crisis was, according to Segal, I no longer remember. But now that Terry and I were now on the last lap of our homeward journey, with our forthcoming visit to India very much in prospect, I must have felt the need to start making myself better acquainted with what had been happening in the subcontinent since my departure from its shores. The need that led me to read The Essential Plotinus was of an entirely different order. Segal's book dealt with matters temporal. The Aeneids were concerned with what Carlyle called the eternities. I had been interested in Plotinus since I was 16 or 17. At that time I was indebted for my knowledge of his philosophy, as of Neoplatonism in general, mainly to the writings of Dean Inge and Thomas Whittaker. For although I possessed the bon selected works of Plotinus, as translated by Thomas Taylor, so abstruse was the thought of those treatises, and so unfamiliar were the terms in which that thought was expressed, that I was able to make very little of them. There was, however, one exception. This was the famous treatise on beauty, which, according to Porphyry, Plotinus's disciple and biographer, was the earliest of the treatises. I usually read the treatise in the translation made by the mysterious group known as the Editors of the Shrine of Wisdom, a copy of which I also possessed, and I never read the slim blue volume without experiencing a thrill of delight, such as I experienced when reading the Symposium or Shelley's Prometheus Unbound. Reading it more than 20 years later in a new translation, I experienced that thrill again. The treatise began, "Chiefly beauty is visual, yet in word patterns and in music, for cadences and rhythms are beautiful, it addresses itself to the hearing as well. Dedicated living, achievement, character, intellectual pursuits are beautiful to those who are above the realm of the senses. To such ones the virtues too are beautiful. Beauty was chiefly visual. This was certainly true of the beauty that was the predominant note of Florence. It was a beauty of form and colour, of symmetry and proportion, of the contrast between dark and bright, light and shade. And the fact that I had responded to that beauty so keenly told me something about myself. It told me that I was a lover of beauty. But beauty was not only bodily. There was a beauty that was supersensible, the kind of beauty of which the Buddha had given Nanda a glimpse when he transported him to the paradise of Indra. That beauty too I could see, however dimly. To that beauty too I responded keenly. It was this keenness of response, indeed, that had helped me to become a Buddhist, or rather, that had helped me to realise that I was in fact already a Buddhist and had always been one. According to Plotinus, just as it is impossible for one born blind to talk about bodily beauty, so it is impossible for one who has never seen it to talk about the beauty that is supersensible. Plotinus continues, seeing of this sort is done only with the eye of the soul, and seeing thus one undergoes a joy, a wonder, and a distress more deep than any other, because here one touches truth. Such emotion all beauty must induce, an astonishment, a delicious wonderment, a longing, a love, a trembling that is all delight. It may be felt for things invisible, quite as for things you see, and indeed the soul does feel it, but souls that are apt for love feel it especially. I had experienced something of that trembling that is all delight while I was in Florence, whether looking at the harmonious complex of cathedral, bell tower and baptistery, at the paintings of Botticelli, or at the sculptures of Michelangelo. And it was perhaps this feeling of delight that had led me to read The Essential Plotinus, in which the first of the representative treatises translated happened to be the treatise on beauty. Be that as it may, the fact that I had started reading Plotinus the night after our departure from Florence, when the spell of the city was still upon me, that I had continued reading him on the road between Oldermatt and Altdorf, and that I was now reading him by a stretch of forest somewhere in France, with the rain dripping from the trees, onto the roof of the little bus. Despite the rain, both Terry and I slept well, and at 10 o'clock, my friend having made tea and I having read a little more of Plotinus, we set out for Metz. It was a warm, sunny day. In the course of our journey, we passed through Mulhouse, Thonne, Col de Bussang, Remiremont, Épinal and Nancy, stopping only twice on the way to do shopping and once for a snack. From Épinal onwards, the countryside was increasingly industrialised. At 6 o'clock, when we were a few miles from Metz, we halted for the night, parking in a beautiful green meadow beside a river. Terry had been a little depressed when we arrived there, but after reading Durant's chapter on Schopenhauer, he declared he was feeling better, the teachings of the so-called philosopher of pessimism having cheered him up considerably. That night I had several strange dreams. In one dream, perhaps a recollection of a previous life, I was attending a party in Greek or Roman times. In another, I was in Gangtok with Kachi Rinpoche, one of my Tibetan teachers, from whom I had received the Padmasambhava initiation and the name Ergyen. Whether on account of these dreams or simply because I had slept well, when I woke in the morning of our last full day on the continent, I felt quite refreshed. It was a fine, sunny morning, and the countryside from Metz onwards, while not picturesque, was sufficiently pleasing to the eye. At midday, having driven through Thonville, Luxembourg and Neufchâteau, and thus crossed into Belgium, we pulled into the side of the road for lunch. It was a beautiful spot, but every 7.5 minutes the quiet was disturbed by the sharp crack like that of a rifle, evidently fired automatically and meant to scare the birds from the crops. Nevertheless, we stayed on there, and after a meal that concluded for once with pastries, bought in Neufchâteau, we settled down to an afternoon of reading. Before my departure from England, the editor of the Middle Way, Muriel Dorr, had given me a book for review. The book was K. Venkata Ramanan's Nagarjuna's Philosophy as presented in the Mahapranyaparamita Shastra, and to this I now turned. As I was already familiar with the author's views, having met him more than once in India, I read the work with particular interest, though so far as I remember, I never found time to review it. His principal concern was to set forth the basic philosophical conceptions found in the Shastra, which, unlike some scholars, he believed to be a genuine work of Nagarjuna, and to show that those conceptions constituted, in any case, a continuation and development of the thought of the Madhyamika Karika, and other works universally attributed to the great Mahayana philosopher. From this, he concluded that Nagarjuna's philosophy was not nihilistic, as some of its critics maintained, but in its ultimate import, positive and affirmative. Quote, "The main purpose of the negative arguments in the Karika was to expose the self-contradictions inherent in the position of the Savastivadins, who clung to the determinate as ultimate, the relative as self-contained. This is the era of misplaced absoluteness. The major function of the negative arguments in the Karika is to reveal the relativity of the mundane. The question of the ultimate reality constitutes a minor part. It is the error in regard to the mundane nature of things that needs to be cleared up first. With the revelation of the essentially conditioned, non-substantial, relative nature of things, the tendency to cling might again operate, tending to end in negativism. This is an error in regard to the ultimate nature of things, and it is in regard to this error that the shunyata of shunyata has been taught. What is sought to be revealed thereby is the non-ultimacy of the relative in their relative nature. The conditionedness of the conditioned is not their ultimate nature. The unconditioned is, again, not anything apart from the conditioned. The ultimate truth about the conditioned is that it is itself the unconditioned reality, the nirvana. This is the basic teaching of the Madhyamika." End of quote. By the end of the afternoon, Terry had taken in enough of Kant and Schopenhauer for the time being, and I enough of Nagarjuna, and feeling the need for exercise, we walked a mile or two up the road in the direction of Dinan, keeping to the narrow footpath between the roadway and the fields. On returning to the little bus, we decided to drive further that evening, and were soon on our way. From Dinan, the road followed the course of the Meuse, and it was on the banks of this pleasant river that we spent the last night of our tour. In the morning, we drove on to Namur, from Namur to Brussels, and from Brussels to Ostend. At 3:30, we boarded the ferry, and half an hour later, it left.